Hey folks, we are live Tech Ed Europe in Barcelona. Ooh. What an exciting time to be a developer. Now, I'm Dan Fernandez. I got to invite my esteemed colleagues here. Seth, why don't you start and introduce yourself
real
quick.
My name is Seth Juarez. I work for DevExpress. I'm the analytics program manager, and I talk about machine learning. It's something I studied, it's something I love, and it's something that we get to talk about because of Azure ML.
Okay, yeah. And Steve?
I'm Steve Teixeira. I run the program management team in the operating systems group that deals with the Internet of Things.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about things.
So we are going to be geeking out on the Internet of Things, how you get data, what kind of gear we're talking about, and what else? All cool things that come. And really, this is trying to be interactive. So what we want you to do is, if you're watching online, ask us questions. Get these guys in the
Please.
Hot seat.
Yes.
If you're watching here, make sure to ask them questions. Send them tweets. We have Rick Claus ready and willing to check answers, not just eat Burger King. So it's a very exciting time. Now, Steve, since you have the coolest thing, why don't we start with what you're actually holding?
I brought a prop. Yeah, so
this is
the Intel Galileo. So what's cool about this is this little Quark CPU right here. This is like a 10-year-old computer. It's a full system on a chip. It's x86. It's like an old original Pentium PC, like in a little tiny 5-millimeter package. In addition to that, you know, it's got USB and networking and an SD slot and all that kind of stuff. It's got 256 megs of RAM. The pins here are compatible with Arduino. So if you're familiar with Arduino, you can slap on Arduino shields to do whatever, temperature sensing or Wi-Fi or what have you. The coolest thing about this, though, is we actually got Windows running on this little tiny board. We showed this for the first time at Build back in April. But if you can imagine, you know, Windows on this little 256 megabyte device, barely a Pentium, but still, you know, still a Pentium. And this is kind of portends a future for Windows of getting smaller and smaller and smaller, running on this little special purpose hardware, and then allowing folks to just make whatever.
So maybe to kind of level set, so where does this board, because there's so many boards
yeah.
and so many different kind of devices, and there's a spectrum, right? Like we have Micro Framework, the community, there's Arduino.
That's
there's
right.
There's so many different devices. Where does this fit? Because this seems even pretty high end. If you can run Windows on it.
That's right.
It's pretty crazy.
I think about the world of devices like a pyramid.
Okay.
And, you know, by kind of the highest value, highest capable computers at the top. And then down at the very, very bottom, you got stuff like RFID that are kind of pennies in cost and virtually disposable. So at the top, you have IoT devices that are basically built on PC chassis.
Okay.
Cash registers, MRI machines, ATMs. Those are all basically PCs with fancy peripherals and fancy cases around them. And then as you kind of go down, you've got mobile devices, you've got things that look like tablets and phones, but aren't really tablets and phones. Like maybe they're the handheld that that the FedEx or the UPS guy would carry around to scan packages.
Mm-hmm.
Not a phone, but kind of looks like one.
Right, ruggedized. You know,
yeah, they can be ruggedized, exactly. And then kind of the next tier is stuff like this, which is about the same processor class as a phone, but a very different chassis. It's, you know, and it doesn't have all the requirements. Like, I don't need to have a screen. I don't need to have a camera. I don't need to have a, you know, a compass or an accelerometer, all the things that a smartphone would have. And I can build a very purpose-built device for lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a tier maybe under this where I would put stuff like Raspberry Pi, somewhat less capable in terms of processing horsepower, very inexpensive, really cool and easy to build stuff with.
Mm-hmm.
If I keep going down, I've got things like Arduino, which now I'm starting to get into microcontroller class processors instead of CPUs. Again, targets the makerspace. I could build stuff, but that same kind of CPU core is an example of something that I might use to build a wearable device, which I usually have wearables on. I chose not to bring any with me today. And then as you kind of go down, so you kind of start at maybe RFID and then go up to things that are based on ARM Cortex M0 type architectures, then to M3, M4, then to Cortex-A, and then all the way up on into x86.
So in terms of sweet spot for scenarios, when somebody says, I would use Galileo for, what are kind of like the key things?
The cool thing about this device is you get kind of the processing capability that people like about something like a Raspberry Pi, but then you get the hardware ecosystem compatibility that folks like about something like Arduino.
Okay.
So where I want to mix those worlds is kind of the sweet spot for this particular device. Now, the cool thing about the fact that it runs Windows is I got the whole Windows hardware ecosystem, so I could literally plug a USB device into the port, and it works because there's a Windows driver.
So when you say Windows, just because obviously the things I'm always wondering is, so does this mean it has the .NET framework? Can I build, you know, like my console application? Do I get HTTP client? Are there, you know, HTTP sys drivers that I can hit Wi-Fi, assuming there was like an Arduino shield for Wi-Fi? Like,
yes.
Where, because Windows means so many things, and I'm just wondering kind of like, What are the key capabilities? Or is it something that you can kind of customize? Remember back in the day with Platform Builder,
yes,
where you could, I mean, they needed an easy mode for that thing, but from...
With CE, you could kind of construct your own platform.
Right.
The short answer is we're still going through the process of figuring it out.
Okay.
Obviously, this device doesn't have a GPU, so that's one big set of Windows that you're not going to find. But you'll basically find all the other things that make it Windows. It's manageable. Most of the Windows API is there. On this particular device, with this build of Windows, it does have the .NET framework, but I have to say we haven't tested it.
Okay.
So people have reported like, hey, I got some .NET stuff working. Hey, I don't quite got it working. Over time, we do feel like we'll get the full framework onto these devices.
Okay. And yeah, so from a developer's perspective, what is the programming model? Are you guys shipping SDKs that talk to it? Is this integrated in Visual Studio?
Yep.
Is it USB or?
I'm gonna violate live decorum and pop a cough drop here.
Yes, yes.
My throat's killing me. So what you can imagine over time is I just go get the Windows SDK. And I could target any device. I could use that SDK to target something ranging from a very small board all the way up to a full, you know, Xeon server and everything, you know, phones and tablets and everything in between.
Ooh.
But the idea here is that if you're a Windows developer, congratulations, you're now an IoT developer.
Yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah, and if you're an IoT developer,
you're lazy like me too. I mean, we don't want to learn anything new.
We're all lazy.
This is
like,
great.
We love what we got. We want to use it.
Exactly.
Like you spend years getting good at something, you kind of want to leverage that knowledge into multiple domains. And so that was one of the big goals. Is like, hey, can we make it easy for people that have Windows programming knowledge to kind of be hardware hackers? And that's one of the things foremost in our mind. There's a converse to that too, which is if you're a hardware guy and you're not necessarily a Windows person or a hardware gal, not necessarily a Windows person, then we feel like a lot of value in the fact that, wow, I get Visual Studio and all that means in terms of tooling.
Right.
I get the Windows hardware ecosystem, so I know a USB peripheral is going to work because I'm going to have drivers for it. All that it means to kind of be able to build apps in a very productive way in the Windows world is something that we feel like we can kind of, you know, I characterize it as we want to come to this community of people building these kind of devices and bring a casserole. Like,
yeah.
We don't want to create a different community. We want to say, hey, great, you're in this community. Hey, here's an OS. If it works for you, great, awesome, you should build some stuff. If not, that's cool too. You could keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, so, and I think, you know, you've been on Channel 9 a number of times too, and I think probably one of the coolest parts is you get the developer space, and obviously you're coming from Visual Studio, so like the importance of things like debugging on a device and stuff like that is awesome. Now, one of the cool things is we actually have some questions. So I'm going to start with the first one. Jason Dean asks, what will be happening with .NET Micro Framework and Gadgeteer, I think is the question. So related to, this goes back to kind of the positioning of how all these pieces. So how does .NET Framework and Gadgeteer fit in here?
It's huge, huge part of our strategy, actually. So when I talked about this kind of device pyramid, right in that lane of devices that run processors that look like Cortex M3, M4 class processors, that's really the sweet spot for Micro Framework. We can't run Windows on those devices. The processor's just not capable enough to run an OS.
Right.
But it's awesome for Micro Framework. And folks that have been paying attention to Micro Framework recently have seen that we've done a bunch of work to kind of put out a new Micro Framework website. We've done a refresh of Micro Framework so it works with the latest version of Visual Studio. We're doing a little bit of work to the runtime to start to address, hey, can we update language support? Can we get some performance work going?
Right.
Debugging support's already pretty good. So Micro Framework, really huge. And what that does is it kind of extends that promise of, hey, you learned to write .NET code, you learned C#. Awesome. You can write that same code on a board that is even smaller than something that would run this OS. So you're talking about as little as 64 kilobytes of memory for Micro Framework.
Wow.
And as small as a Cortex M3 processor. So things that, if you were to build one of these boards, you could literally get the bill of materials for the whole board, like down under $10 if you, you know, if you really tried hard. These are very inexpensive devices.
Yeah, I think I'd buy like 20 of those just because I'd like step on them and have them all over. It'd be awesome.
There are two good developer stories, at least two. There's more than two, but two that I like a lot. One is Gadgeteer, which is a company called GHI, probably the biggest maker of these boards, where you can plug in lots of devices. It uses Micro Framework, and it's a really easy, accessible programming model designed for people that are not developers, kind of easy enough for young grade schoolers to start building their own hardware.
Mm-hmm.
The other is NetDuino, which is an Arduino-compatible board that runs Micro Framework. So I could use all those Arduino shields, and I can use Micro Framework, and it's kind of a low-cost, very accessible device.
Yeah, absolutely. So Al has a next question here. Is there a place for NetDuino in Win10 IoT, .NET native, hint, hint?
That's a good question.
So clearly he's looking for a commitment.
This is somebody on my team that was up late at night like going, I'm gonna ask Steve this question. I just mentioned NetDuino, and so that's certainly a part of our strategy in the Windows 10 wave. In terms of .NET native, it's something we're definitely looking at, and it's something we'd really like to be able to do. The great thing is .NET Micro Framework is an Apache-licensed open source project. So, AL, if you're feeling entrepreneurial, help us out. Like, let's get some native compilation going on this thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so Seth, have you been doing any development on this stuff? Because this gets back to how gadgets start getting into the cloud. Why are we doing this stuff? When we talk about Internet of Things, there's the fun scenarios, which I do want to get to, more like how we can hack our houses.
Sure, yep. Sure.
I'll get to that. But what are some of the commercial things, and how are people using things like machine learning?
That's a really good question. I have done the NetDuino Make the Light Blink demo. It was the most exciting thing ever. If you've done that before, it's like, hey, it blinks. Yeah. And my wife's like, okay, you're a computer guy. Yeah. That was really good for you. Thank you for, I got to go wash my hair.
Yeah, that's right.
But the thing about these devices, when it comes primarily to IoT, is there's this thing that I like to call data exhaust.
Okay.
Where things are producing this inordinate amount of data. Imagine having a device really anywhere, and this thing is producing data and pushing it somewhere. How do you analyze that data? It's really easy to look at just a couple of rows of data and try to understand a pattern, but now when these things have this just tremendous data exhaust, how do we analyze it? How do we use it to our benefit? And how do we make business value out of these little things? It turns out the machine learning primarily is designed to find the patterns in the data in order for you to extract the best business value. And I think that's the coolest thing about sort of the IoT machine learning. I didn't know we were doing IoT, but it just goes really hand in hand.
Yes.
Because you need to be able to look at the data and make sense of it.
So take a step back. People who don't know what Azure Machine Learning is, what is Azure and Azure ML, if you will, and why should people care?
It's a really good question. I'll take even a step further back and explain the rudiments of machine learning. Machine learning is really the process whereby we try to generalize things in a way to make decisions. So there's two areas. There's a supervised learning and unsupervised learning. Supervised learning is where you have a set of things or data and you want to learn a specific outcome. Like, for example, in the IoT example, it would be, hey, at this particular traffic light, is there going to be traffic? And you have a device sort of measuring how many people there are, et cetera. That's kind of an easy one. But that's a supervised learning case where you're learning a specific thing. The unsupervised learning case is when you want to get structure out of data, like the Amazon use case where you have a bunch of products and you want to know, hey, who am I like? And so that we can both sort of buy the same things. And that's a cool thing. So that's a step back. Now, to go to Azure, one of the biggest problems with machine learning is the amount of space it takes and the amount of computational power. And so when I used to run these models on my machine, I would run out of memory, or there wouldn't just be enough space on my hard drive. But now with Azure, you're sort of, this constraint is removed. I think there's a 10 gigabyte limit on the amount of data you can do right now. But if you're using 10 gigs of data to do analysis, that is, you are coming up with some tremendous models. So now imagine being able to process a lot of data, make very meaningful models to do prediction in the cloud. And so you don't have the constraints of memory or CPU. It's pretty exciting.
So for somebody that's never built a model before, so I don't know if you want to talk about the constrained or unconstrained version, but like, what am I actually doing? Is this markup? Do I like give it a schema of
Good question.
Assume I know nothing and you'd be right.
Okay. So here's what's going to happen. You start with a square of data. Imagine a table of data. And you're going to have a particular column that you want to learn about.
Okay.
So for example, imagine it's a true or false column. This is called binary classification. Mm-hmm. Very simple case. So you have this column where it's true or false, and you have all these other columns that you want to use to predict true or false. Let's see, for example, here's a really good example.
If you're
using
Azure, PG, right?
Azure websites. Yes, Azure websites, you have tons of log data, right? And you want to know if someone is trying to attack your website.
Yes.
Right? And so you have all this log data, and then you go ahead and you mark it up afterwards and say, yeah, this was an attack, this was an attack, this wasn't. And so now you have this big square of data with all this data, whether it was an attack or not. What's going to happen is once you've cleaned up your data, which is probably the longest part, it's called yak shaving in our industry, right? You have to make your data clean. You have to line it up with the right stuff.
I'm sorry, you called it what?
Yak shaving. You haven't heard that term?
Okay, no.
Yak shaving. It's everything you got to do what you got to do. Like the boring computer stuff.
Wasn't it called ETL, extract?
I've never had to shave a yak to do anything. Like,
you guys haven't heard this? Come on. This is computer science.
All right, sorry.
Look, go type yak shaving.
I am not typing that into a browser. I don't trust you for 1 second.
Bing yak shaving with Google, and you will find it, okay? You will find it. And so it's pretty much just cleaning up your data. Once you have your data in a state that's good, now what you do is you put it on Azure ML. Azure ML lets you sort of clean your data, lets you do the yak shaving.
But how does it do that? Can I pause? What are you actually doing there? So like in an ETL, like normally you'd say like, okay, if there's null, then give it this.
Yeah.
If there's
How does that work though? If there's missing values, you can say, hey, replace the missing values with a zero, replace it with an average. You can also say remove duplicate rows. You can also do things like filter or set a benchmark. Like say if the number is between negative infinity and positive infinity, you can clip around the borders so that it pushes the data so that it all fits in this little box. Like you want to be minus 1,000 to positive 1,000. You can clip that. And so it's just the matter of getting the data in a usable form for
And them. Is this, like, am I writing if statements, or like, what does the actual code look like? Is it like a SQL-like thing?
No code. In Azure ML, you literally drag on your data. It's Windows workflowy. You drag your data on there. You drag a filter, for example. You link it up. And then you can, for example, drag another one on to, say, remove values or split columns or take out columns or do whatever. And so that's what you're doing. You're literally doing Windows workflowy kind of thing.
So I have my shaved yak.
That's right. You have
from
your shaved
the workflow.
Yak. That's right.
And now I need to do the
model.
The prediction.
Yeah, you need to do the modeling. So it's a four-step process. You start with your data.
I've done modeling, but I think this is different.
Yes. You start with your data, you clean it up, then you build a model, and in supervised learning, you do prediction. So to build a model, it's pretty simple. Once you have that sort of output with the right data, you drag in a training module, you link it up, and you tell it what kind of model to build. In machine learning, there's several supervised learning models. The one that's easiest to understand is decision tree, because it makes this sort of tree for you. And what you do is you give it the data, you train it by saying, here is the data we're going to use to train it, here's the data we want to learn, and then it spits out a model.
Okay.
And
now,
then,
is that like optimization? Like, how do I get the most cars through the drive-through?
Yeah, the models themselves tell you whether or not how to use the optimization. So, for example, for decision trees, you're really just looking at the columns and seeing which one gives you the most benefit first, and then you split. And then on the remaining columns, you find the one that gives you the most benefit, and then you split again until you have a certain height of the tree, or you finish it out, right?
Okay.
In this case, it's called decision tree algorithm. You use what's called information gain. It's a pretty easy thing, but it's literally glorified counting. The computer does all the counting. But in the end, you come up with this compact model that enables you to predict whether or not someone else comes in. You see this in the log. You can predict whether or not it's an intrusion problem.
You see
what I'm saying? Because you've actually used the log. You've actually used the log from beforehand. You've labeled it intrusion, not intrusion, intrusion, not intrusion, and then you give it a new example. And then you can do prediction with the new model. And for prediction on Azure ML, it's pretty cool. Because now what you can do on the scoring module, you can say, this is the input, this is the output. That becomes a web service.
OK.
And now you can give it an example
of something. So it's now a service, so you can do kind of the real-time thing?
That's right. So now once you have a trained model, you can say, OK, here's another example of our web log. Is this an intrusion or not? And it will return and say, according to our model, it is with this percent confidence.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Imagine having these kinds of machines combined with the data that it exhausts out, the data exhaust, and now imagine being able to produce these huge models to real time make decisions about things anywhere with these little devices or your website or whatever. That's the supervised case. The unsupervised case is where you're trying to group things. So for example, on your website, if you want to be able to build a recommendation engine, really easy to do it on Azure.
Now, do you run into like the correlation causation things, like the number of murders versus number of IE penetration?
Yes, like? It's weird. Now, here's the thing. Like, machine learning people and statisticians are like different. Like, they're very mathy. We are like the engineer, right? The mathematician will take half steps to the wall and never get there. We will be close enough. Right, so yeah, correlation does not imply causation. It's very true, but it's good enough to make good predictions with a certain amount of confidence.
Right. Okay, so we have another question from Al. How much machine learning do I need to know to get started with Azure ML? Are there more general learning resources on ML in the Azure docs?
Yeah, I actually went through the Azure docs. They're very good. Once you understand the four-step process, you can start to pick out which the modules you use for each process. The first one is you need to get your data. You can either use the example data that's on there, or you can use readers to pull from HTTP endpoints or blob storage or whatever. So once you have your data, then you need to clean it up. And you'll see there's tons of modules to clean it up. Mm-hmm. Once you clean your data, then you need to train your model. And to do that, there's a train module. There's a train model module and that you attach to the data and then you attach to the right model.
So let's get back to this, because on the cleaning data part, it was like a workflow-ish tool.
Yes.
On the creating a model, is that also, or is it like a declarative language, or
no.
How's that work?
It's like a workflow-ish tool. So now once you've cleaned your data, you take the output of your clean data, you pass it into a training module, and then that module has two inputs, one for the data and one for the type of model you want to do, for example, decision trees. And then in the output, you have to score it and then see how well it's done, and then you can set the endpoints there.
So there's a manual step of you scoring something based on that?
Okay. Yeah, so here's an example. How do you know how well these things are doing? That's kind of a complicated question. There's no way to know. Unless what you do is you take your data, your clean data, and you separate it into two parts. One for training and one for testing.
Okay.
And so now you take your, let's just say 80%, you train the model on your 80% of data, then you take your remaining 20% and see how well does it do on that. And there's a number of scores. There's something called recall, there's something called precision, there's something called accuracy. It will tell you how well these models are doing, and then there's this AUC score, which is sort of this area under a curve, and the more that it covers, the better it's doing. You can see how well it's doing.
Okay.
And so it's the whole thing is like a workflowy thing. So it's pretty powerful. The thing that I like most about it is that now I don't have to be constrained by space or computation because it just runs it. And that's really the coolest thing.
Now, for a regular average developer, how approachable is it? You think they could just like something they could set up in an afternoon. Like I like the idea of basically using it for intrusion detection.
Yep.
Is this something easy to set up, get going, or
if you remember the four steps?
Or do I need to be a scientist to do this stuff?
I
is maybe the easier
we're
way to
all
ask it.
All scientists, because look, here, let me tell you about the term science. Right, I think we use it wrong. I don't think it is what we think it means.
I experiment.
Science is we don't know. I have an idea. Let me try it. It usually doesn't work, so we go back and say, well, I have a better idea, and you refine until you get something that you have a working theory that seems to be working. Science is just trying stuff. So the stuff you're going to try on Azure ML might not work the first time, but it's okay. The other question is, what parameters should I put in? Science. I don't know. Try something, right? Until I have an idea. Let me try something. And so it's not quite like that. There's a lot of Wikipedia in there too, obviously, in during the process, right? But once you sort of get the model and the workflow, the cool thing about Azure is you can try 10 different models at the same time and see these things plotted against each other.
Okay, interesting.
And so now once you have the model, then you can use that model to do prediction.
So the other interesting part is, if somebody's done some stuff, like, I'd love it if I could borrow, you know, that person's code or model or prediction analysis. Yes. So, you know, whether it's, like, somebody does a great political rating system for, you know, one particular country, you could then use that same model. Like, is there any concept, or do you know, is there like the Facebook of ML to share and learn what other people are doing?
Or the GitHub of models.
Maybe GitHub's a better example, because I don't know if you want your model updating a status.
There's a place called Kaggle that lets you try out experiments that's really good to do that. But the biggest problem is, once someone comes up with a really good model, they kind of don't want to share it. So I know about like
five
or six.
Wait, I thought this was science. Wait a minute.
I know about five.
I guess if you know the stock market one.
Yeah. I know about five or six things that people have asked me about that I can't talk about because I'm not allowed. And so that's the thing, right? It's just once you come up with a really good model, there's so much business value. Like the data exhaust that you produce is usually proprietary. It's something that you have spent a lot of effort to create, and once you've extracted a really good model out of it, people usually don't share. But the cool thing about Azure ML is that this is an environment that, as an organization, you can all run experiments, and you can all share trained models within your organization. Whether you want to do it intra-organization, you can certainly do that. You can add another person to to your experiment set, because they're literally called experiments because it's science. Right.
Let me tie these together a little bit, Dan. Like one of the other things our team's been working on is the cloud services that take the data that's being off-gassed by all these devices.
Right.
And they could be this, or they could be data from an anti-lock brake system, or from a transmission in a car, or from a factory floor, what have you. All these IoT devices, they all go in. What we've tried to do is kind of optimize the schematization and then uploading of that data from device into Azure. Because the ultimate endpoint is to get it into ML.
Right.
What people want to do is typical scenarios, something like predictive maintenance. Wouldn't you love to know that your transmission's going to go out maybe a month before when the signals exist, rather than when your transmission exists on the pavement, on the freeway, when you're cruising down five. And kind of optimizing that. Once if you're a car manufacturer, like once you get that great model that predicts transmission failure, you're unlikely to share that with another car manufacturer. It turns out that that's a pretty decent competitive
it's
advantage.
It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. So the ingestion side, what's the name for that on the Azure side, where you're able to take shock and awe kind of data from millions or billions of devices and scale that up?
So the core Azure, there's a bunch of, there's like a, you know, bingo of different names of technologies in Azure that go into building this kind of IoT solution. Service Bus is kind of the front end for a lot of this data
that
gets ingested at high scale. We've talked a lot about this product that's in private preview called Intelligent System Service. Unfortunately, shares the acronym with the space station, but if you get past it kind of aggregates Service Bus and Azure Storage and some security thing, you know, a bunch of different things into one kind of easy end-to-end. So I could actually start in Visual Studio, and I could build an app for a device that says, yeah, this is my schema. Let me declare it either in .NET or in C++. And then here's my credentials for my Azure endpoint. Go. And as this runs, it'll start by uploading its schema to the service, and then it will just start pumping data. Really, really easy. And as a developer, you actually don't have to necessarily care, wow, there's Service Bus and there's, you know, table storage and blob storage.
That makes sense.
And I'm doing, you know, event processing on this thing, and I'm listening on queues. You don't have to know any of that. You can, if you want to build a really highly customized solution, you can get in and you can go crazy, but you also don't have to. We've tried to design it so it's kind of pay for play. Really easy to get data into the ultimate destination of ML or other kinds of BI. But then you can, if you want to open up the hood and like play with the fuel injector, you're more than welcome to do that as well.
So let's use some of the like the car example. So if something's simple, how is it actually getting data? So it's on my car. How's it getting to the cloud and then, you know, I don't know, maybe emailing me before there's some issue? Like, how does it actually work? Plus, it needs, like, some level of security, right? Because otherwise, like, I could just be like, I'll send a message to Seth's car.
Yeah,
I don't think he's leaving today.
Thanks.
That's right. Yeah, security is a big deal, right? It's not just wireline privacy, which a lot of people think, you know, I got SSL. Man, I'm good.
That's kind of what I assumed.
but you kind of want to make sure that the car that it purports to be is actually the car that you want to be receiving the data from.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make sure that the car itself hasn't been compromised. And so you very quickly start to get to this thing that lands at, wow, what I really want is I really want TPM level security, even on the smallest devices, so that I can ensure that the boot path hasn't been compromised. And what I really want is I want some sort of strong certificate-based identity in the hardware so that I can identify myself to a cloud service in a very, very secure way. The cloud service not only knows that the data is private, but it knows exactly which device it's talking to. So those are some of the things that we do to kind of to provide that level of protection.
Right.
In terms of how it gets to you, it actually depends on the car you bought. Some cars will have 3G or 4G built into the vehicle, and they'll upload telemetry. Some cars will use your phone as the tether itself to your phone and use it as the gateway to send data up. It really depends. Our implementation today uses the AMQP protocol to send data into service bus. You could also use REST and use any kind of REST capable thing on the device to send up using plain old REST APIs.
And that's also the other thing is these cloud services work with any kind of hardware to send in data, right?
Doesn't matter.
Like, as long as you could send the REST request, for example,
okay. That's right. If your device can speak REST or it can speak AMQP, or in fact, one of the things we see customers doing is kind of standing up different kinds of protocol gateways in the cloud because they want to speak MQTT. Or, you know, we have some customers that kind of have to pay for every byte. And they're like, no, really, my packet needs to be like 12 bytes.
Wow.
Right.
And so they do this highly customized protocol in order to have a very, you know, short and efficient data exchange. And then they'll translate that in the cloud to whatever it needs to be to get into the data pipeline.
Yeah, so the connection point may not even be HTTP. It may be something much lower level like sockets or TCP, or is it like the services are really HTTP only?
Typically, when I think of binary, I think of spinning up your own. No, because you do need some of the ceremony around security and things like that.
Right.
So it's a little more than just, you know, hey, you know, IP address, blah, 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 port
send
number, blah, 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 blah,
raw
go
socket,
for it.
Yeah.
So typically people will use well-defined protocols. HTTP does tend to be chatty. But people will go to REST or AMQP. People will go to MQTT. They'll do something that is standards compliant often, but also very, very efficient.
And some of those acronyms, AMQP, QMTT. Do you want to just quickly talk about what those are? There's like the message queuing protocols.
Yeah.
Right?
So basically, they're message queuing protocols. Different message queuing protocol standards. AMQP is the thing that Service Bus uses today. MQTT is an open source thing. I think it was started years ago by IBM.
Okay.
As a part of an MQ series thing, if I'm not mistaken. Different variations on the same thing, quite honestly.
Okay.
And most people that kind of come to the party with a point of view. They're like, hey, I've already got some stuff. And that's the other interesting thing about IoT, is we don't find a lot of situations where we talk to a customer that really wants to get serious about IoT. And they're like, man, we're just getting out of MS-DOS, and we're ready for IoT, so we're going to do everything from scratch brand new. You know, typically, they're pretty smart about this already, and they're already generating bunches of data. And they kind of want to modernize the infrastructure, and they're like, wow, we built all this stuff in our private data center that's really hard to maintain, and frankly, it has no business value for us to maintain this data pipeline into Business Insight. So maybe Microsoft, you could do that. And then we'll actually focus on figuring out when the transmission's going to break, because that's the thing that really is going to create business value for us.
Right, right. Plus, I think it's the other things like, wow, there's 19 data centers. So, you know, if you're doing anything in, at a global scale, it's just that much easier rather than standing up infrastructure in Australia, for example, since
it gets super
expensive.
That was
our latest data center.
That's right. It gets super expensive for enterprises as they scale out. You know, one, just volume of messages coming into the data center.
Right. Right.
But then two, global accessibility, and then how many nines do you want to have as a part of this solution? As you start to add all of that up, it makes much, much more sense to come party on some existing infrastructure, working with a company whose job it is to kind of stand that stuff up and keep it running, and you can figure out how to do predictive maintenance, for example, in a way that makes sense for your company.
Right.
So do you guys have some examples of companies that we could actually talk about that are using it? Like, what's a like the classic IoT case study or machine learning where they're like, yes, so-and-so is using this, and here's why, and...
Yeah.
Sure, I think the easiest one to understand is maybe Facebook.
I've heard of them.
Yes, I don't know if you guys, that's a popular website in Europe, I think. So
I think it's popular
so
here, too.
At Facebook, what it does is the way it makes money is it sells ads. But it doesn't, if you click on it, that's when they make money. So their job is to give you the best ad possible. And so what it's doing is it's using machine learning to group your likes and then sell what you like to your friends. So do this to screw up yourself and all your friends. Go to your Facebook site and click on all of the banners and like everything. And so now not only are you going to hose yourself because it's going to show you all sorts of weirdness, you're going to hose your friends. It's just a beautiful thing. Because what it's doing is it's learning your likes. And because it has a direct knowledge of who the people you're friends with, it will sell the things that you click to your friends.
So, like, and then because it knows your friend graph,
yes,
the closer friends Facebook thinks you are, the more likely they are.
Yeah, not only that, but there's two things. There's this thing called collaborative filtering, which lets you pick a product and say you really like it. So here's a Netflix example. Netflix is the movie place. When you rate a particular movie 5 stars, what you're saying is, I like this movie. And so what's going to happen is the computer is going to find all the other people that are like you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's going to group them together. And what it's going to do is say, okay, our computer says you belong to this group of 100 people. Let's add up all of the stars and just say you want this one because everyone else did. So if you want to hose people, start putting 5 stars on all sorts of weird stuff, and then people that are like you will start to get weird things too. That's collaborative filtering. You are literally feeding the machine learning animal every time you like something, every time you give something a star.
This is like the ML equivalent of a photobomb.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Now, like, do you actually do this, a personal question?
No, I should. I should write a bot to do that.
Okay.
So then the other thing is called content-based filtering, where it's you find things that are alike. So say the computer doesn't know anything about you, like Amazon. You go on there and you say, you put this product in the cart. What it's going to do is it's going to find all the products that are similar to it. Now, similarity is a machine learning thing. And there's a couple of ways to find machine learning, to find similarity in the unsupervised learning case. So that's a really good example of unsupervised learning for recommender systems, whether it's collaborative filtering, content-based filtering, or some amalgamation of both. So that's machine learning. You can set up these models in Azure.
Yeah, so when I need my dating site for...
That's right. When you,
totally. Yeah, absolutely.
I will give you a couple more examples. I'm going to give you a real one, then I'm going to give you a fake one that I think is a better illustration.
Okay.
A real one is we worked with a partner, ThyssenKrupp, big company that does, among other things, elevators.
That's right.
And so they worked with us on a proof of concept inside of Azure using the Intelligent System Service to do things like predictive maintenance on elevators so that... from a business efficiency standpoint, instead of kind of rolling a guy with a truck to like every X period of time to go check on it, you know, look at the flashlight up there, yeah, it looks okay, all right, on to the next one, you can actually get real-time feedback and then use ML to predict like, hey, you might want to structure your route this way because, you know, these ones are more likely to need service sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. And there's a case study on this one that folks can go look up.
Oh, great.
The fake one that I think is a really great illustration, though, is let's say you run a network of vending machines. You have soda fountains. And if you have soda fountains, the way that you do business the old way is every week you send a guy in a truck full of syrup and carbonated water to go refill your soda fountain. Like, okay, time to restock all the beverages, great. So every week they're gonna do that. Sometimes they're gonna find, wow, I got to this vending machine and it's all full. Wow, I shouldn't have come here. Or they're gonna find, wow, I got to this vending machine and turns out the Coca-Cola's empty or the Pepsi's empty or whatever. Sure. And I should have come earlier. Like, I really missed an opportunity. I missed a bunch of cola sales. And so in the simplest case, you can use this kind of thing. This isn't even about ML. This is about simple insight into machines that are operating in the field. Like,
right.
Tell me when I'm 20% full on this thing so I can go proactively do it. Then you can kind of, once you get there, you can operate a little more efficiency, roll your trucks less frequently. Once you get there, then you can do things like, I know that it's going to be, 30 degrees Celsius in the location of this set of vending machines next week. And I know, based on the ML I've done on previous summers, that people drink a lot of Juju Cola when...
It's my favorite, by the way.
Yeah, thank totally. You. People drink a lot of Juju Cola when it gets that hot out, so you can actually start rolling trucks to proactively restock these things in advance of some predicted out of stock. So anyway, totally made that up.
Yeah, it's great to go from like kind of a crawl, walk, run, right?
So you could have a device like this at your place measuring these things constantly and sending that data up to the cloud all the time.
You bet.
And you could see this stuff with graphs or dashboards or whatever. You could say, that location's going down. And you can see, the thing about this is now once you have data, you can do so much stuff that you otherwise couldn't do. And it's just not about ML. It's about displaying charts or graphs or whatever about the kind of stuff that you're doing. Right? Right. It's the visualizations that matter.
So, Steve, I have to ask, like, in terms of home hacking, and you know, we probably need to shut some stuff down because we're running out of time. Like, is this intended for home hackers? Like, hey, get this and play. Sort of, I'm thinking like the Maker Faire crowd. And I realize there are, like you mentioned, the pyramid. But like, what are some cool things that you've seen maybe the community take and kind of run this with?
Yeah. So to answer the first question, definitely. One of the things that we're actively trying to do right now is to join that movement. We think it's really fun. We think it's interesting, and we think we have something of value that we have a casserole that we can bring to the party and just people like it. Great. It helps us kind of understand what's happening in this kind of cool, hacky. What are the new set of devices that people are building? We're doing some things, both ourselves as well as what we're seeing our friends and partners build out. One of the things we showed earlier this year was this life-size piano, a la Tom Hanks and Bill.
Oh, right,
nice.
Yeah.
That was running on one of these little devices.
Oh, I remember that.
And that was really cool. We get a lot of requests for that thing to show up, some kind of stuffed animal
Weddings
character.
Weddings and bar mitzvahs, yeah.
Right.
But we see everything from, in fact, in my hotel room right now, waiting for my session later this week, I've got an RC car that runs on one of these. So we ripped out all the electronics and we put in one of these boards to actuate all the motors in the car. And then I use Bluetooth and my cell phone to drive the car.
Oh, nice.
So
nice.
Interestingly, it turns out that if you take a low-end Lumia phone, like a Lumia 520, 530, they cost $50 or $60 without a contract in the US. That's like the awesomest accessory for a maker. I've got a 4-inch touch screen, I've got Wi-Fi, I've got Bluetooth, I've got cellular, I've got all these sensors and cameras, and it's amazing. You could never buy all those things for even close to the same cost that you can acquire one of these phones. And so just another example of some of the cool things that we've been able to build out.
So you mentioned your talk, and since we're running out of time, why don't you guys plug your talks for both people kind of watching around here and viewing online?
Sure, absolutely. I give a talk on Azure, machine learning on Azure. Primarily, about maybe 3/4 of the talk was spent getting you familiar with machine learning concepts. You can view that at AzureConf, because I did it at AzureConf, and then whenever the recording happens, I did the talk
yesterday. All sessions will be recorded here, too.
Cool. So if the session I did, it was Monday at 5 o'clock, which happened to be yesterday, feel free to take a look. And always, you can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Seth Juarez. I'm happy to do that.
Awesome.
Great.
And see you.
So I'm talking on Friday. I'm talking about the client IoT platform for Microsoft. So you'll see this. I'm going to start at the top of the pyramid and basically show demos and build a number of devices all the way on down the pyramid. Demo God's willing, I'll actually get through all this stuff because it's going to be fun. If you're interested in seeing either spectacular success or someone crash and burn dramatically, highly recommended to attend that particular session. It is on Friday, though, so if folks are too hungover, you know, they can catch it on video.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So awesome. This was so great, guys. I really appreciate the time.
Cool.
And thanks again for everybody watching online.